The Katra Podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge, simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome back to the deep dive. Today, we're getting into something we all grapple with, whether we admit it or not, honesty. Or maybe, more accurately, dishonesty. We're looking at Dan O'Reilly's fantastic book, The Honest Truth About Dishonesty.
Yeah, and the goal here really is to unpack this idea that might feel a bit strange at first. We tend to think of dishonesty in terms of, you know, huge scandals, the Bernie Madoffs of the world.
The villains.
Exactly. But Erily's work shows that actually most of the cheating, the financial costs, the moral compromises, it comes from ordinary people, people like us.
Uh-huh.
Just, you know, bending the rules a tiny bit. So we want to understand why. What makes us do that?
And why it matters is, well, those tiny bits add up, right? Think about millions padding expense reports just a little, or fudging tax deductions, maybe taking some office supplies home.
Sure. Stuff we barely think about.
But collectively, the cost to society, both financially and in terms of, like, social trust, it's actually way bigger than the damage from those few big-name fraudsters. It's this everyday stuff that really needs a closer look.
It's the science behind how we manage to cheat a little and, you know, still look ourselves in the mirror and think, yeah, I'm basically a good person.
So who's guiding us through this? Dan O'Reilly. He's a very well-known behavioral economist, professor at Duke University.
James B. Duke professor, yeah.
Right. And many people will know him from his earlier book, Predictably Irrational. He's kind of the expert on why we humans often don't make logical choices.
But what makes his angle on this topic on honesty so unique, I think, is his personal story. It's quite profound.
Oh.
Yeah, when he was younger, he suffered really severe burns over, like, most of his body. It meant years and years of incredibly painful medical treatments.
Wow, that's awful. How does that connect to studying cheating?
Well, during that incredibly difficult time, he became a keen observer of human behavior under stress. His own, other patients, the doctors, the nurses. He saw decisions being made about pain, about treatment, that seemed, well, irrational.
Mm.
And it sparked this really deep, empathetic curiosity in him about human motivation, why we act against our own interests sometimes or against logic, especially when things get tough.
So it wasn't just an academic interest in irrationality. He lived through its consequences. That personal angle, combined with his, you know, experimental rigor, it makes his approach really compelling.
Exactly. He doesn't treat morality like some abstract philosophy. It's something you can actually test. You can design experiments to see what pulls our moral compass off course.
Okay, so what's the first big idea he tackles?
Well, he goes straight for the traditional economic view of crime, the standard assumption. He calls it SMORC.
SMORC, like SMORC.
Yeah, the simple model of rational crime. It's basically the idea that people are calculators. You look at a situation like, should I cheat on this? And you weigh the potential gain, say, getting $500 against the chance of getting caught, times the punishment if you do get caught.
Pure cost benefit. If the potential reward seems higher than the calculated risk, you go for it.
That's the theory. A rational person cheats when it pays. But Erily found, through his experiments, that this model just doesn't hold up. It misses the psychology.
So what's his alternative?
His core idea is the fudge factor. He found that, yeah, most people will cheat if given the chance, but critically, only by a little bit.
The fudge factor. That's the wiggle room.
Exactly. It's this internal conflict we have. On one hand, we want the benefits of cheating, maybe getting more money or saving time. But on the other hand, we really want to feel good about ourselves. We want to see ourselves as honest, moral people.
So the fudge factor is like the cognitive space that lets us cheat just enough to gain something, but not so much that we have to admit to ourselves we're actually dishonest.
Precisely. We grab a few extra napkins or round up our hours slightly. We get a small benefit, but we instantly rationalize it. It's no big deal. The company expects it. It barely costs anything. And crucially, this factor, this fudge zone, isn't fixed. It changes depending on the situation.
Okay, let's get into the evidence. How did he actually show that the old SMORC model was, well, wrong?
It started with a really clever baseline experiment using these things called matrix tasks.
Matrix tasks?
Yeah, basically sheets of paper with grids of numbers. The task was to find pairs of numbers in a matrix that added up to exactly 10. Simple, but tedious.
Got it.
In the control group, an experimenter checked their answers carefully. But in the cheating group, participants were told to count their own correct answers, then shred the worksheet, and just tell the experimenter how many they got right.
So virtually zero chance of being caught if they lied.
Right. And people did cheat. On average, they'd solve about 4 matrices, honestly, but they'd claim they solved around 6.
Okay, so they cheated, but not massively. They didn't claim they solved all 12 or something.
Exactly. And here's the part that really undermines SMORC. Ardeasley's team tried increasing the incentive. They offered much more money per solved matrix. What happened?
Logically, according to SMORC, cheating should have gone up. More reward.
It didn't. The level of cheating stayed almost exactly the same. About 2 extra matrices claimed. Then they tried making it even easier to cheat. Practically impossible to be caught. Still no change.
Wow. So the amount of cheating wasn't driven by the external reward or risk calculation?
It seemed to be driven by their internal limit. How much they could cheat and still feel okay about themselves. That internal fudge factor was the real constraint, not the external economics.
That's fascinating. And then it gets even more relevant to today with this idea of psychological distance.
Oh, absolutely. This is huge. So they ran the matrix test again, same setup, but instead of paying people cash for each solved puzzle, they pay them in tokens, plastic tokens, that they then had to take like 10 feet across the room to exchange for actual cash.
Okay, a tiny extra step. Seems trivial.
You'd think. But cheating doubled.
Doubled? Just from using tokens instead of cash?
Yep. Because that one small step remove the act from the immediate feeling of taking money. Tokens, points, credits, digital entries on a spreadsheet.
Mm-hmm.
They don't trigger our moral alarm bells the same way grabbing physical cash does.
So when I use my company credit card for lunch and maybe round up the tip a bit,
mm-hmm.
that feels less like stealing than taking a $5 bill from the till.
That's exactly the idea.
Yeah.
The psychological distance makes the rationalization much, much easier. And think about how much of our economy now runs on abstract forms of value, not physical cash.
Yeah, that's slightly alarming. It makes it easier for that fudge factor to expand, doesn't it?
It definitely seems to. And that connects to another point.
Yeah.
What happens when we're just tired? Chapter 4 in the book talks about ego depletion.
Ego depletion. Sounds serious.
It just means our self-control is like a muscle. Making ethical choices, resisting temptation, it takes mental energy. And that energy runs out.
How did they test that?
They give one group of participants a really draining mental task first. Something like resisting delicious cookies placed right in front of them. Or memorizing long strings of numbers.
Okay, so they were mentally worn out.
Exactly. Then they put that group into the standard matrix task where they could cheat.
Ah.
And guess what? The depleted group, the tired ones, they cheated significantly more.
So being stressed, fatigued, maybe multitasking too much, it actually makes us more likely to cut ethical corners.
Yeah, because we just don't have the cognitive resources left to fight the temptation or even to construct the rationalization against cheating. Our willpower is low.
Hmm. And it's not just internal states like fatigue, right? The environment matters too. This idea of moral spillover.
Right. This was a surprising one. They did an experiment where they gave participants designer sunglasses to wear while doing tasks. Some got authentic ones, others got fakes, and they knew they were fakes.
Okay. Wearing fake sunglasses. So what?
Well, the people who knowingly wore the counterfeit sunglasses were then significantly more likely to cheat on a subsequent unrelated task.
Get out!
Yeah. It's like wearing the fake signaled something to themselves. I'm the kind of person who cuts corners or rules are flexible. That one small act of dishonesty, even just wearing a fake, seemed to lower their overall moral threshold. It's sometimes called the what the hell effect.
Like, oh, well, I've already done this little thing. What's one more?
Something like that. And this effect can spread between people, too. Chapter 8 talks about social contagion. This is super important for workplaces.
How so?
They set up the matrix task at Carnegie Mellon University. In one condition, an actor posing as a CMU student, clearly an in-group member, stood up after just a minute, blatantly claimed he'd solved everything, got paid, and left.
Okay, obvious cheating and getting away with it.
Right. And when the observers saw their fellow student do that, cheating levels among the rest of the group shot way up. It was like the social norm had just shifted. Oh, I guess this is okay here.
Wow. But what if the cheater wasn't one of us?
Ah, good question. They ran it again, but this time the blatant cheater wore a sweatshirt from a rival university and outgroup member.
So?
Cheating among the CMU students actually decreased. They wanted to distance themselves from that other person's bad behavior. It shows how powerful group identity and social norms are in shaping honesty.
That makes sense. Okay, one last really interesting finding you mentioned. Creativity. That seems odd.
Yeah, it's counterintuitive, right? You'd think creative people might be more ethical, maybe.
Yeah.
But Ariely found that often more creative individuals are actually more prone to dishonesty.
Why on earth would that be?
Because creativity isn't just about painting or writing poems. It's about finding novel connections, thinking outside the box, generating new possibilities.
Okay.
And that same skill makes them better at rationalizing. They can construct more elaborate, more convincing stories to themselves about why bending this particular rule in this specific situation is actually okay. Their creativity fuels their ability to justify their actions within that fudge factor.
So their imagination helps them stretch their own rules further while still feeling honest. That ties it all back to that self-deception idea.
Exactly. It's all about maintaining that self-image.
Okay, so if we step back and look at the big picture from all these experiments, what are the main themes coming through?
Well, theme number one has to be the incredible power of rationalization. The main driver of everyday dishonesty isn't pure greed. It's our amazing ability to tell ourselves stories that let us benefit from cheating while still feeling like good people. Self-deception is key.
Right. It's not that we don't have morals. It's that we're really good at navigating around them when it suits us. Yeah.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And theme two, which is really important in professional settings, is unconscious bias and conflicts of interest. Ariely points out that many ethical failures aren't necessarily malicious. Think about doctors recommending a treatment made by a company they consult for, or financial advisors pushing a product they get a commission on.
They might genuinely believe they're being objective.
They often do. But the conflict of interest, subtly, unconsciously, biases their judgment. They rationalize why this specific treatment or product really is the best, even if objective data might suggest otherwise.
That's a tricky one. And the third big theme.
I'd say it's that morality is highly situational. Our honesty isn't some fixed personality trait, like being tall or short. It fluctuates wildly depending on context.
You mean like being tired or seeing someone else cheat?
Exactly. Stress, fatigue, the environment, who we're with, whether we're dealing with cash or tokens, all these transient factors dramatically influence our ethical choices from moment to moment. We're not consistently honest or dishonest. We're honestly adaptable.
Okay. The book also has some really punchy ways of summing these ideas up, right? Some memorable lines.
Absolutely. He's great at crystallizing these concepts. Maybe we should share a few key ones.
Yeah, let's do that. What's one that captures that core fudge factor idea?
How about this? We cheat up to the level that allows us to retain our self-image as reasonably honest individuals.
Right. That perfectly describes the balancing act, doesn't it? Cheating just enough, but not too much to shatter our self-perception.
Exactly. And then there's the one about the scale of the problem. The collective economic impact of many people taking a little bit is vastly greater than the impact of a few individuals committing massive fraud.
That really shifts the focus, doesn't it? Away from just chasing the big Madoff-style criminals towards thinking about the systems that allow or even encourage widespread minor dishonesty.
Yeah. And related to that, especially for today's world, cheating is a lot easier when it's a step removed from cash.
The psychological distance thing again, it's such a crucial warning as everything becomes more digital and abstract. It just lowers the barrier.
It really does. And maybe one more about prevention. When we are removed from any benchmarks of ethical thought, we tend to stray into dishonesty.
Meaning we need reminders. Like we need our moral compass to be actively switched on.
Pretty much. It suggests that just reminding people of ethical standards at the right moment can make a huge difference. Our morals can be easily forgotten if not prompted.
Okay, so let's make this practical. What are the real life applications here for us, for organizations?
Well, for you listening, personally, it means being really aware of those vulnerable moments when you're exhausted, stressed out, rushed. That's ego depletion kicking in.
That's when the fudge factor might expand without you noticing.
Exactly. So just being mindful in those states can help. Also, consciously think about psychological distance. Maybe try using physical cash for discretionary spending sometimes.
Like for coffees or impulse buys?
Yeah. That little bit of friction, actually handing over money, it can make you pause and think in a way that just tapping a card or clicking buy now doesn't. It connects you more directly to the cost.
Okay, that makes sense. And what about for companies or organizations? Is there anything practical they can do based on this research?
Definitely. And one of the most powerful findings offers a virtually cost-free solution. Timely moral nudges.
Delicious ads.
Yeah. Remember the finding that ethical reminders help. Airily tested this with things like expense reports or insurance forms. Usually you sign at the bottom after you filled everything in, attesting it's true. He found that if you simply move the signature line, the declaration of honesty, to the top of the form so people sign before they fill in the details, cheating is almost completely eliminated on those forms.
Wow. Just moving the signature line.
Yep. It primes their sense of honesty right before the moment of potential temptation. It activates the moral benchmark before they start entering numbers. It's a simple system design change, way more effective than just threatening audits later.
So policymakers, managers, tech designers, they should be thinking about building systems that reduce ambiguity, reduce psychological distance, and maybe incorporate these kinds of ethical primes.
Absolutely. It's often more effective to change the environment and the structure than to try and change people's inherent nature or rely solely on punishment.
So wrapping up, what's the biggest single takeaway you get from this book?
For me, it's the shift in perspective. Promoting honesty isn't really about finding inherently good people and punishing the bad apples. It's much more about designing environments, processes, and systems that support everyone's better judgment.
Making it easier to be honest.
Yeah. Recognizing we all have that fudge factor and creating conditions where it's less likely to get stretched. We can't eliminate dishonesty entirely, but smart design can seriously reduce it.
What surprised me most, I think, was just how effective those really simple psychological interventions were. Like asking people to recall the Ten Commandments before a task or signing that honor code at the beginning.
Yeah, the effects were dramatic.
It showed that our moral compass isn't necessarily broken or absent. It's just sometimes dormant. It needs a little nudge, a reminder to point true north again. And that feels, I don't know, kind of optimistic, actually.
I agree. Understanding our flaws gives us the tools to manage them better.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.